In July of 1984, historian and photographer Leland Rice gave a talk at Linfield College, just outside of Portland, titled California Photography Since F-64. I was fortunate enough to attend that lecture, and he was gracious enough to allow me to put a microphone fairly close to the podium, so it's a pretty good quality recording, even though it's originally from a cassette. Obviously, as you'll hear, this was a slide lecture, and this audio recording doesn't capture the slides and the visuals he used. But nonetheless, I think there's a lot here that's well worth hearing. Here's Leland Rice on California photography since F-64.
Tonight's speaker, Leland Rice, I think is someone who needs no introduction. To most of you, are very familiar with him. So here's an introduction. Leland got his undergraduate degree at the University of Arizona and his master's degree at California State University in San Francisco, where he studied with Jack Wellpott. And I think it's relatively significant, something I always like to see are people who practice photography who also have very strong interests in the history of photography, and this certainly applies in Leland's case. He's done a great amount of curatorial work. I think spent something like 6 years as a curator of photography at the galleries at Claremont Colleges. Organized the Frederick Summer Exhibition that was on tour back around 1980. And has worked as a co-curator with Susan Ahrens on the Imogen Cunningham exhibition that will be here at the Portland Art Museum next year. I guess really I don't need to say a great deal more. It should be a very interesting talk this evening. So, Leland Rice, thank you again.
Thank you very much, Terry. I noticed there's a canopy covered piano behind the screen here, so you ought to call upon Don Wirth to bring that out when he's here, and he's quite a pianist amongst being a great photographer. It's a great pleasure to talk to you tonight about a very minor topic that, as you have read, called California Photography Since F-64. Those of you that are technically inclined might realize that F-64 refers to a rather small aperture opening that most cameras of contemporary design do not afford you. But cameras in the days of Edward Weston and the likes, it was quite usual that at least you had an F64 f-stop to make very finite, detailed exposures. Basically, the topic tonight I want to try and cover is, as I see it, a sort of development of what might be underlying as modernism in contemporary photography that I feel began as much here on the West Coast, and particularly centered around Edward Weston and his attitudes and work, as anywhere else in the world in terms of what we know and appreciate today as modern contemporary photography. So what I've done is I've devised a series of slides that basically, in a very sketchy manner, and hopefully not overly dogmatic, trace the development of fine art photography attitudes. And I emphasize fine arts because there are many different attitudes, as you well know, in photography, and I'm not excluding any purposely, but I am going to associate primarily on the fine art direction in photography. My premise is to begin with a brief discussion on the two tenets of pictorialist photography, as was practiced and preached by none other than the infamous William Mortensen, which parallels both in terms of time period, the 1930s and 40s, with what we know as the development of the modern work of Edward Weston. And then from that, I want to take you through briefly the 40s and 50s in photography in California, discuss and mention some of the major practitioners and attitudes, and then dwell upon, in the latter part of the talk, on the 60s and 70s and the development primarily of the educational impact and influence, therefore, on photography as we know it today. There are a few photographers, to my knowledge, practicing in California, where I still live, that have not had at least some or total involvement with a educational institution, either as a student being trained in or actually teaching at major institutions today. Prior to 1960, that was not particularly the case, as we well know, and it's been a phenomenon of the last 20 to 25 years or so. I might finally mention an exhibition that has recently was curated and occurred in San Francisco, amongst some controversy, as is the nature of such an exhibit, called Photography in California, 1945 to 1980. I might also preface that I've been giving semblances of this talk for about 6 or 7 years now, but some of it will parallel the information in this book, and some of it will actually disagree with some of the information in this book. But it is a very fine reference, both visually and in terms of the research and writing, and I do recommend it. If you can get a hold of it, I believe it's 1995, as you see it here as a softback, and maybe you can prevail upon local bookstores, if they don't have it, to order some copies from the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, which is where it originated. It is, as many publications these days are, one of a kind. Hopefully, this kind of exhibition will and publication will cause other people to do research, and I might even make some suggestions tonight in regards to some kinds of photography I'll be showing as to some areas that are tremendously under-researched and very little is known about. For instance, Japanese pictorialist photography in the Northwest and on the West Coast between 1920 to 1940, prior to the unfortunate internment of the Japanese Americans during the war, which caused much, and in fact most of that work, to be totally lost, destroyed, misplaced, or simply ill-cared for. So with that in mind, I'd like to get right into the slides. So if we want to douse the lights and get the projectors warmed up. This is kind of a fortuitous positioning here of the left slide as you're facing the screen there, sort of towering down and looking down with one of William Mortensen's photographs titled The Sorcerer, peering over to a group of photographers that were in fact the pioneers behind the F-64 group that we know today. And I'm sure that you recognize many of the names there on the list of F-64. This is actually a slide of the original announcement announcing their exhibition. They actually had one primary exhibition in 1932 at the De Young Museum, and in fact they were a very informally knit group and not the sort of formal group that we sometimes associate with their impact upon photography today. And it is by setting up these two tenants of Mortensen and the F-64 group that I want to focus on. So here we have immediately the contrast between William Mortensen and his rather gothic, very sexually somewhat revolting as rather revolutionary imagery on the left, and a 1925-26 image by Edward Weston simply titled Nude. And I think here you can see immediately the kinds of image concerns and the kind of crafting of the work to suggest the sort of directions that are going to be at somewhat odds here. There was a publication in California in those days called Camera Craft that was edited by a Mr. Young. And in Camera Craft, both Edward Weston and William Mortensen, and somewhat later Ansel Adams, had quite a rivalry of discussions and position papers about the different attitudes towards photography. The print by Weston on the right, by the way, is a platinum print. That's why the coloration is such as you see it. And predates really his California work as we know it. He came back from Mexico for a short period of time in 1925 and actually made a few nudes at that time. went back to Mexico and returned to California in the late 26. This probably says it as well as any two images to compare the two. The human relations of Mortensen, as you can see, is a rather bizarre series of images where he used a lot of different techniques. His basic feeling was is that the hand of the artist and the alterations of photographic information was totally necessary for a statement to be made that was more relevant to what the person had in mind. So he reverted to many different techniques, and in fact was quite inventive and revolutionary in the techniques in those days. He originally came from Utah to California in the 20s and went to work for Cecil B. DeMille on numerous films, including The King of Kings. And in fact, he did do some remarkable on-the-set photographs, still photographs, of some of the actors during their actual acting roles while the cameras were rolling. And he, along with Edward Curtis, somewhat pioneered still photography in the movie industry. But unfortunately, I think he got carried away with the fantasy of Hollywood in the movies, and he had access to the Western Costume Association in Hollywood, which had something in the neighborhood of 10,000 costumes to his for his use, and set up a studio there, and began to do numerous sort of allegorical, if you will, harking back to the 19th century photographs. On the other hand, Weston, on his return from Mexico, began to investigate the purity and directness of large camera format photography and began to do a series of vegetables and shell close-up images, many of them taking 3 and 4 hours in length of exposure. And the artichoke heart you see on the right here, I think, is an excellent example of what Weston was attempting to do in those days. Quoting from Nancy Newhall, who wrote an article in Camera Craft in 1941 titled, "What is Pictorialism?" She says this. She says, unfortunately, talking about the pictorialist photographer, he has come to designate for almost all of us the work of a group of people who have thought too much about the word pictorial and not enough about the word photography. The majority of them are sincerely groping for expressionism and have no idea that what they are doing and how they are controlling their muddled minds in thinking. She goes on to say that their efforts are to imitate a school of painting that died more than 30 years ago. Remembering this article was written in 41. Others less often identified with pictorialism try to strictly operate on optical or chemical means to give their photographs the look of a current art fashion. These are the people with constant thinking in photography. They think about patterns, elaborate stage sets, which they carefully pose models and other objects to be photographed, and sometimes even revert to sculpture. I think that's a very interesting comment in that, as you will see later in the work of the contemporaries in California in the 60s and 70s, that in fact there was, as had recently been coined, a term, fabricated to be photographed, a whole attitude about studio-orientated art-making or object-making in order for the purpose of being photographed, which she in fact mentions here in relation to pictorialism. The aim of this group is the same. The imitating of painting and the thinking of both is sharply and basically confused. In terms of Mortensen's publications, his most influential one was called Monsters and Madonnas, as you see on the left, and is indicative of some of his attitudes towards, it was a book of methods, and it kind of paralleled the straight photograph, as he saw it, also the allegorical photograph, and it dealt with this kind of idea of highly manipulating the image. He had long theses on why pubic hair was unattractive and should be airbrushed out, for instance, He had attitudes towards the S-curve and other kinds of very formal academic, painting academia attitudes of composition. As you can see on the right, a Weston photograph of Karas done about 1935 when he lived in Santa Monica, that the directions again of the two photographers were quite a bit at odds, and the simplicity and directness of Weston capturing a certain natural sensuality was quite a bit at odds with, of course, Mortensen. So you say, well, of course, Weston had another career in photography, and sure enough, he did. These two photographs you're looking at are of the dancer Rue St. Denis that were done in about 1914, 1915, when Weston was a commercial portrait photographer in a pictorialist style, using soft focus lenses, a lot of retouching of his negatives and things, which, of course, he was later to refuse to do when he was in his Carmel location. And yet, I think when you look at these two images of St. Denis, they're still very remarkably contemporary within the time frame of when they were done. I think particularly the one on the left, where she's sitting in a doorway in a rather unflattering pose, and yet the sense of projection, the presence of her there, and the softness of the rendering, I think is quite remarkably contemporary, given the photo secession work of the time and other reigning pictorialist attitudes. On the other hand, this being 1914-15, if you keep in mind these two images by Mortensen done in the 1950s, yes, you heard me right, the 1950s, upon retirement down in Laguna, where he taught upwards of 300 students or thereabouts throughout the year, teaching them and indoctrinating them in his pictorialist philosophy and craftsmanship. He did what is referred to as metal chromes, which is a technique that I'm not all that familiar with in terms of how it was done. And supposedly some of the pet theories or craft of the technique has died with Mortensen. But on the right, I simply point out that that's a 1952 image of the actress Jeanie Crane, done as a kind of Dutch painting, if you will. Style that is completely impregnated with color in the metal chrome process, but it is in fact a photograph that you're looking at. And the one on the left is also a Mortensen image done in the 50s titled Fertility. And again, the most striking contrast, I think, is looking at the working areas and the studios that the two photographers worked in. Mortensen on the left, actually doing probably one of his chemical abrasions or whatever techniques on an image in his workshop, which is equipped with airbrushes and all kinds of artist tools of sorts. Hardly looks like a darkroom. And of course, Weston's very simple darkroom that has actually been reconditioned during a time when in Wildcat Hill, area of Carmel Highlands, when at one time they were going to turn his small house into sort of a museum for the public to visit. And this photograph was taken at that time. But you see in Weston's picture on the right, you see the simple wooden device up on the wall, which was a flat printing area where he would contact print his 8x10 negatives. And he simply had, as you can see, a light and a switch and a simple area of the sink for the processing of the print. Now, the F64 group was made up, as you saw on the first slide, of a number of rather well-known photographers today. And Imogen Cunningham got the idea that they should sort of all photograph each other and make portraits, which is what the gentleman Rollins, who was the head of the DI Museum at the time, wanted them to do so that people could see what they looked like. So many of the photographs on the left were done during that period. Willard Van Dyke in the bottom picture, sort of resting with his leg up, was really the catalyst spearhead, along with Ansel, of this group. Edward Weston, who was never in his lifetime, to my knowledge, much of a joiner of any kinds of groups or activities like that, was basically talked into participating with the group in terms of exhibiting his work. Ansel, of course, Preston Holder, who was a close friend of Willard Van Dyke and moved to Nebraska a few years after that, and I believe was a professor of anthropology or something like that at the one of the universities back there. And Alma Levinson, who is, I believe now, unfortunately, the only, along with Willard Van Dyke, the only surviving member of F-64 today. And on the right, you see a photograph of Sonia Noskowiak, actually done by Imogen Cunningham in the early 1930s, who was also a member and student of Edward Westing. And on the left is a photograph by Alma Levinson of Consuela Kanaga, who is another participating, invited member of the group. On the right, you see a photograph by Ansel Adams, which is typical of the kind of work that he was doing in the early 30s and the kind of work that he would have exhibited at that time. Of course, one of his most important early images was this picture in 1927-28 done in Yosemite. And by Ansel's accounting, it was one of his first successful photographs where he, using the term pre-visualized, through the camera at the time of exposure, what the final print image would look like on a piece of photographic paper. And at that time, Ansel began to conceptualize this whole idea of pre-visualization, which was, of course, later to be formulated into his concept and teaching techniques of the zone system, which he was later to teach at the California School of Fine Arts in San Francisco. Imogen Cunningham, who it should be noted, along with Edward Westing, they were the two, in terms of age, senior members of the group. I think many of us lose perspective or sight of the actual relationship of Westing, Cunningham, and some of the others. Imogen actually was 3 years older than Westing, having been born in 1883, and in 1932 she would have been exactly 49 years old, which for some people is kind of like beyond mid-career. In this case, it was just sort of beginning a very important period of her own photographic career. And here you see on the right her rather well-known Magnolia Blossom, done in 1925, one of her, I think, classic plant images. And on the left, a very infrequently known image from the Museum of Modern Art, done in the early 1930s. The picture on the left might, in fact, be one that she would have exhibited at the F-64 exhibit. And these two pictures are kind of short previews of an exhibition that I fortunately had an opportunity to co-curate with Susan Ahrens on Imogen's work. And I show these as two vintage prints you'll be able to see here in the Portland Museum in, I believe, spring of 1985. And I propose that of all the photographers, not only related to the F-64 group, but in general to American photography as we know it, that Imogen's work has much closer alignment to many of the attitudes prevalent in Europe, and particularly Germany, and the new objective photography of the time. And part of that reason is that she spent a certain short period of time studying in the 1910 period in Germany, and she continued correspondence and subscriptions to publications, of which there were many in her library upon her death. And also she participated along with Edward Westing and Brett Westing, as well as some East Coast American photographers, in the very important film and photo exhibition of 1929 in Stuttgart, Germany, which was probably to photography what the Armory exhibition was in New York to the general art world and painting world of America. Unfortunately, we still have not had an exhibit of that magnitude here in America. Anyway, these are two prints that were done in the late 1920s, and very likely pictures like these were included both in the F-64 exhibition as well as the Stuttgart exhibit. And some other photography from that time. Sonia Noskowiak on the left, in case you people can't afford the auction record for Charles Sheeler. You might consider a very fine photograph of the light nature of a train by Sonia Noskowiak. Alma Levinson, I think it's the Carquinez Bridge, might stand corrected on that, done in San Francisco in the early 1930s. But there was a fascination at that time in architectural and the sort of new design age of architecture as a subject matter, which was quite prevalent amongst photographers at the time. Brett Weston, also a member of the F64 school, and two pictures that he made in the late 20s, early 30s. I think it's interesting to contrast this plane of the early 1930s, the design, the sort of streamlined design of the airplane, to the well-known sand dunes that he's photographed over the years. Again, on the left is Alma Levinson in a still life study. And on the right is a Japanese pictorialist that practiced first in Seattle, I understand, and then later in Los Angeles, California, where he still lives today at the age of 90. And his name is Harmona Kura. And it's just simply titled Glasses, and it dates, I believe, 1928 is the date on the picture on the right. But there's a remarkable, that still exists, a remarkable body of work by a group of Japanese-based photographers out of Los Angeles, and there has been a small exhibition done of that work. And these are two more photographs. Again, Kira on the right of an origami arrangement, and Toya Miyataki, who might be the one photographer that people would have heard of. He is quite well known for fashioning a camera out of a shoebox or something while he was interned in one of the camps, Manzano, I think it was, near Fresno, California during the 1940s, and actually photographed the goings-on there. And he did a series of a dancer using light and tracings of light in this particular photograph done in the early 1930s. So there was a certain parallel activity, not so much related to what we know as American photography of the 20s and 30s, which would be more realistically based and which became more epitomized in the attitudes of Walker Evans, Dorothea Lange, and the Farm Security Administration and the likes, in relation to Edward Weston and what he was fashioning as an attitude of working on the West Coast. But here you have, I think, in this work, by the Japanese pictorialists, a very close affinity to the directness and the experimentation of some of the European photographers of this period. One could look at the picture on the left, for instance, and it might suggest Mahaly Naja, or it might suggest a rather abstract Man Ray, or someone like that. In 1932, Weston's first publication was released, and in it were such photographs as the Pepper image 1930 on the right. And this was the first publication of its kind and had great impact when, I think it was a publication limited to 1,500 signed editions. And it was it had quite an impact for those that were able to get a copy. And out of that, I show you the slide on the, go back on this one. I show you a Brancusi sculpture image dated 1916 called The Princess as a modern relationship in terms of attitude and form to the Weston Pepper. So Weston, as you can see, was much more in line with and much more aware of much of what was going on in modern art than the pictorialist ever could be, or cared to be for that matter. In 1938, Weston received the first Guggenheim grant ever awarded to a photographer and traveled amongst, 37, and then he got it renewed in 38, and traveled amongst the Southwest and California and made some wonderful images as an example on the right there. And I think one of the many outstanding ingredients that Weston brought forth in his work is a certain ability to carry through in the print this incredibly sensuous quality of the material that he's working with. Of course, the film in the camera, and then, of course, the print itself. And I think as you look at this slide, which is fairly representative of the quality of the print, if you could see it directly, it does convey not only the sensuality of his response to shape and how he saw the sand dunes, but actually the quality that I refer to as a sensuality of the surface of the photographic print. And I feel no photographer before Weston was able ever to quite captivate and capture that quality in photography. And he was able to, I think, take that to its highest ability. And of course, Ansel Adams continued to work in the 30s, 40s, into the 50s. And here you have, I think, two somewhat contrasting but rather representative landscapes of Adams. Of course, the one on the right should not need an introduction to anybody. And therefore, you see the photograph on the cover, which is David Octavius Hill and Robert Adamson, Scottish photographers that collaborated in the 1840s with the first paper process, the Talbotype. But in addition to that, there are many other areas, and Adams was particularly responsible for putting together the fine arts exhibitions. He invited Mahaly Naja, for instance, to, at this time in 1940, Mahaly Naja had immigrated to Chicago to establish a new version of the Bauhaus in Chicago from Germany. And Mahaly was invited to establish or to do a an exhibition of his work and other experimental work. There were scientific exhibitions, there were documentary exhibitions, all kinds of innumerable exhibitions put on for this particular 1940 fair. It took place in San Francisco. On the right you see a photograph by Peter Stackpole, who as a young high school teenager scurried up the top of the building of the Bay Bridges and made some remarkable photographs, which of course later were published in Life magazine, of which Stackpole became a photographer for. Also about this time, the emergence and the importance of a school in Southern California, which is still quite alive today, is the Art Center School, which now is called the Art Center School of Design. It has moved from its what was its Third Street home to Pasadena, actually. And there, photographers that wanted to commit themselves to a very commercial approach to photography and get quite a broad education could go and learn their trade. And one of the earliest students there for a period of time was Wynn Bullock. At that time known as Percy Bullock, and also Todd Walker went to school there in the early 40s, and later on even Lee Freelander went to school there in the 50s for a while. It's a very rigorous program in the fundamentals of craft of photography, and also the commercial aspect is certainly emphasized. Here you can see a number of the instructors listed over there, and this is a picture on the right by Fred Archer. Unfortunately, his work has literally been lost. For what reason, I don't know, but none of his work can rarely be found. This is a photograph out of one of the annuals of photography back in the 30s. Ed Kamansky, who heads the list up there, was actually not a photographer, but was like a painter, and by Todd Walker's accounting, Kamansky was one of the most successful teachers there for those that wanted to venture off into somewhat untraditional approaches to the use of photography. And Will Connell is another photographer of some note. And here on the left you see a Will Connell image of 1933. And even though he was primarily known as a commercial photographer, he did some very remarkable experimentations. And has even a book published of multiple images that he did based on sort of Hollywood. And on the right, you have the well-known expatriate Man Ray, the artist. And in California, there began to be an influx because of the war and all of numerous artists that came west for various reasons. Of course, the movie industry was a very big reason to call them to come west. Man Ray actually left France, where he was living in 1940, came to New York, and for some untold reason, immediately rented a car and drove to California, where he lived until 1948-49, when he decided to return back to Paris for the remainder of his life. But Man Ray epitomizes the kind of witty, surrealist, actually Dadaist artist. He always was one to challenge the mediums and the attitudes in art. And he got very interested, particularly in photography, in the 20s. He's very well known for his photograms, which he coined the term rayogram for. And later, when he came to Hollywood, he did numerous things as well. On the left is an example of one of his photograms that he did while in Europe. And on the right is actually a montage collage called The Girl as Nut, or The Girls as Nuts, or Walnuts might be a more accurate term. And it is typical of the kind of combination of photography and newspaper collage that Man Ray was so well known for. But the point here is that with the likes of Man Ray, for instance, being in California for a while, he did teach at the Otis School of Arts and also at the Art Center. He did lectures there and all, although he really hated teaching and tried to discourage any amount of it, but of course everybody needed money in those days. He also had exhibitions in California while he was there. So he did have quite an impact indirectly in terms of people being exposed to his work and to his sort of freeing up attitudes and his kind of Dadaistic inroads into things. This man, I'm sure, needs no introduction, but of course he also came west. He thought he would do some actual photography in the film industry, but was less successful at that, so he decided to do a West Coast version of his rather well-known book called The Naked Eye, which is based in New York. And so, of course, he did a Naked Hollywood. And here you see on the right a photograph done in 1945 when he was in Los Angeles. He came to Los Angeles in approximately 45 and worked there until about 48 for about 3 or 4 years. And both Man Ray and I think Ouija in particular here and a few others coming up in a minute are indicative of the kind of, if you will, transient nature of Southern California in particular, but also the adventuresome spirit that Southern California and California in general provided for these people to come west. And they actually did do very significant groups of work here. In this case, he went into a motion picture theater disguised purportedly as a popcorn salesman. In those days, it was popular for the concessionaires to walk up and down the aisles. I don't know if any of you remember those days. He masqueraded as a popcorn salesman, had his 4x5 Graflex with flash attachment, which he had covered over with some sort of a gel, so that when the camera went off, as you can see, the two very embracing subjects here were not even aware of it. But his most incorrigible work was this series here, or examples of this series. As you can see, he was not the world's greatest speller on purpose. But he used distorted lenses purposely to try to reinvent, I suppose, cubism to some degree in photography, and made the pictures like this of many different people. Probably his Marilyn Monroe photographs, though, were his most kinky. L.A. has also been a kind of sad ending, end of the rainbow, I guess you might say, in the case of these two photographers. I suppose if you peer hard enough, you will notice who the author is of those rather ridiculous photographs on the left. I should not ever say that in New Orleans, because they happen to own those photographs in their museum collection. But nevertheless, Edward Curtis, you heard that name before? He totally broke came to L.A. and I don't know exactly what the dates were, but anyway, he ended up at the Biltmore Hotel for a good deal of time as a kind of a local photographer, making his daily bread. And some of the kinds of pictures he unfortunately had to do after doing the incredible series, as you well know, of the North American Indians for over 30 years, were these kinds of images. He died in 1952 or 4, I forget the exact date, literally unknown and penniless. On the right, you see also the unfortunate ending of a great photographer's career, Paul Otterbridge, who you might know from doing those beautiful advertisement-based photographs in the 20s, and certainly every bit as good as the Steichens and the all the rest of the photographers of commercial bent in those days. But he came west and he tended to make these very superficial and again rather kinky, bizarre, pre-Playboy hustler and what have you photographs. This is actually a photograph to promote a box of candy. These were remarkable in terms of the fact that they were Carbro prints, color prints, and he was really a very fine Carbro printer. Unfortunately, I might also add that most of his really great first-rate Carbro prints we will never see. What you are unfortunately seeing are his toss-aways, and he in fact had intended for those to be destroyed upon his death. Unfortunately for him, they were not. Fortunately for the marketplace, I suppose you could say they're still in existence. But if you ever get a chance to see a really first-rate Carbro print by Paul Otterbridge, it's a rather remarkable crafted object, irregardless of the image content. Hollywood was kind to other photographers. We're stepping back briefly in time here. 1928, Steichen came out and photographed, of course, Greta Garbo. And this is the last of a series of pictures he did when he was given very few minutes to set up his camera in the hallway between the stage set and her trailer, where she would come to kind of collapse for a few minutes. And of course, he had to use his initiative, and he supposedly took one of those round back chairs and threw his dark cloth over the back of it after he had pre-focused the camera and had all the lights set up and everything. And she simply, it was a barrier that she simply had to deal with when she came streaking down the hallway after coming off the set when she had flubbed her lines in, at one point. And so supposedly the story goes that she plopped down in his chair and he made five or six, maybe seven quick exposures. And at the very moment he's making the one on the left, the director is saying, "Miss Garbo, Miss Garbo, it's time for you to return to the set." And she's looking back in her wonderful, scornly manner at where the voice is coming from. And of course, Steichen has made one of the classic images. On the right, of course, is another classic by a gentleman still actually working in Hollywood, George Harrell. And these are, of course, matinee idols of the 40s, Loretta Young and Tyrone Power. Or should I say 30s? I don't quite go back that far myself. We jump to the 50s, but I thought the contrast might be rather interesting, if not in fact significant. As you can see, the author of the left-hand picture is Cecil Beaton, where he was, he set up for about 6 months in a hotel, I believe it was the Ambassador in Los Angeles, and photographed numerous people related to the film industry, including Marilyn Monroe. And if I hadn't seen the signature Beaton, I might have thought it was an early Diane Arbus, but I find it a very remarkably penetrating photograph of the rather agonizing life of being a famous movie star. On the right is another, I think, remarkable image that has unfortunately not been known, and that's by Robert Frank, and it's simply titled Young Aspiring Actors at the waiting in line to be to either proofread or whatever their lines in Hollywood, 1956. It was part of the series, of course, that he was doing on his Guggenheim grant, which later became the publication The Americans. But Frank, as you know, went back and forth across the country quite often and did a lot of work in California. Now we come to the beginning of, I think, the significant evolution of education in photography. And one of the major forces, as you know, and you can take some credit for it certainly, is Minor White, who, prior to coming to California, was living right here in your fine city. I forget what he was doing here, but he was doing some very menial thing, like maybe he was working at a hotel or something like that, making photographs, writing poetry. He was invited to come to San Francisco by Ansel Adams, who at that time in 1945-46 was heading up the Department of Photography. Ansel had actually taken some time off from a rather lucrative commercial photography career and was teaching at the Art Institute. There's a bit of a confusion between whether Minor White was invited by Ansel Adams to come to the school to actually help teach photography, or in fact, whether he was invited to become a student of Ansel Adams. Some feel that the latter is maybe more accurate, depending upon who is telling the story, or who has what facts in order. Anyway, upon arrival there, White obviously found it to his liking, and quickly assumed a major role in the both the teaching and finally the shaping of that very fine school and that department of photography. What you see on the right is a series of photographs that Minor actually did in San Francisco between 1947 and 1953-54. And it's from a rather remarkable exhibition that I would propose that Minor White had some impact on or influence, and that is a show called Perceptions, which was at the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art in 1954, where each photographer, and I will show you more of these in a few minutes, was asked to submit, without the author being indicated, photographs for exhibition, and they were all hung in a sort of certain ways by the curators, who were Don Ross and Dodie Thompson Weston at the time. And the only time that you could even make inroads into who made what photographs was they had these small cards with small blow-ups on them, as you see here on the right slide. And one of the photographs, as you can see on the left, is this street worker here on the left, and it kind of personifies, I think, some of the attitudes of the sort of psychological direction that Minor's work went in, both before they came there and particularly developed as he was there. And the picture on the right is called Ritual Branch and is, I think, quite indicative of the kind of work that we associate with Minor and the kind of the sort of self-revealment and self-investigation that he emphasized in his teachings and in his own work in particular, and also suggests some of the kinds of attitudes that were not traditional to photography at the time. I always like to think of sort of three canons, if I can remember to paraphrase them relatively accurately. One was let the subject generate its own composition, which of course could be attributed as easily to Edward Weston. And in fact, Weston did say something close to that in his Flame of Recognition publication by Mancy Newhall. Another was something to the effect of be still with yourself until the subject of your attention affirms your presence. And another went something like, when the subject mirrors the man, and the man mirrors the subject, something else might happen. And I like to think of Minor's work in the sense that sort of the continuation of, and this is certainly not original in what I'm saying, but the continuation of Stieglitz's concept of equivalence, where you not only take the photograph for what it appears to be of or about, but also for what else it might become or what else it might be to you very personally, and to elicit from the audience a kind of a certain experience that's more emotive and personal, on a personal level than on an objective level. One of the very early successful sequences that Minor is best known for occurred in San Francisco in 1947-48, called Song Without Words. And as I understand it, his practice was to alter the sequences over the years, and sometimes pictures would be extracted and other times pictures would be added. But the sequence I'm going to show you is from his publication in 1969 called Mir's Manifestations, and Mir's Messages Manifestations, and apparently was done with his approval. These photographs were made just south of San Francisco, a few miles, so some of the areas might be recognizable to you. And when I had two occasions to see Miner in his lifetime show his work, and it was a very remarkable experience where he would sit very quietly in a room at an easel with one light on and would very slowly show you one photograph and another photograph and another photograph. And the basic sort of evolution of his display of his work was that it wasn't one image that you were supposed to concentrate on or became the main signifier of the work, but rather to see them in a kind of like a continuation or a sequence in this case. And so I show you these slides. I think there's a 12 altogether, reading left to right, and you're to sort of view them in a kind of sense of continuation. And he did also say that in this particular sequence, he was actually on a hillside, in effect, thinking about a very close friend that was still across the ocean in 1948 during the end of the war and the occupation of the different islands in the Pacific, and that this is what moved him to make this this series. Anyway, Miner taught at the California School of Fine Arts and developed a program up, and in 1952, the birth of Aperture occurred under the editorship of Miner White with the help of a lot of other people. In San Francisco, and that was the first major publication devoted exclusively to the writings and reproductions of photographs on creative photography since Stieglitz's Camera Works. And initially, I understand, when it was set up, it was to be published for exactly 15 years, which was the length of time that Camera Works was published, circa 1903 to 1917. During this exhibition that I spoke of a minute ago, Perceptions, these are some of the photographers and the very photographs, in fact, that were included in the exhibition. And so you can see it ran quite a diverse, in diversities between Edward Weston on the one hand and Dorothea Lange on another. And although Lange resided in California and her home, of course, was Berkeley, a great deal of her photography, of course, was done on location and out of the state of California, although during the 30s she, of course, is well known for photographing the migrant workers and all. And I think that even though she did have some impact, particularly on the likes of Edward Steichen when he became the director of the photography at the Museum of Modern Art and was in 1955 to construct the exhibition Family of Man, that she had, I believe it's safe to say, a bit of a less of an impact upon the evolution of creative photography as we know it today in California. I would therefore simply reiterate that Everett Weston and N. Minor White, along with Ansel Adams and Imogen Cunningham and then Wynne Bullock in a few minutes, became the main focuses of attention by young photographers. Here, of course, you recognize, I'm sure, Imogen Cunningham. You may not recognize Rose Mandel, but she did some very important work. Very close friend of Imogen. They went out photographing a lot together. And she's maybe going to finally get back to some photography these days. She lives in Berkeley and is passively thinking about it. But I think they're remarkable images. Again, she's from Poland, by the way, immigrated to this country. And so, again, her work, Mandel's work, has very much of a overtone of European, the closeness of the face, the close cropping, the objectivity, again, of the subject. And when Bullock and Donald Ross being one of the main forces behind this particular exhibition, I mentioned Miner White's relationship to the exhibition because later in the 70s, when Miner was at the MIT school, he did a series of exhibitions that some of you may know about. The first one was Light to the Seventh Power, or Light 7, and then he did one called Celebrations and another one called Being Without Clothes, and where he basically requested photographs to be sent in, and then did very elaborate sequencing in a very poetic way of the work. And I feel that that this 1954 exhibit really was sort of like the benchmark exhibit to suggest the nature of sequencing, and also the sort of the sense of the authorless photograph, where you don't attach a name or therefore a marketplace or reputation importance to the image, but you respond to the image more directly and subjectively. Win Bullock, 1957. He spent many years after his training at Art Center School of Design, first in LA and later in Monterey in the early 50s, exploring and developing many attitudes in relation to line photography and other kinds of solarization attitudes, published a number of papers, got a number of patents on processes and all. And of course, we best know him through his landscape and other photography associated with the Monterey area. And I think I can say that in the 60s, as a student in the Bay Area, that Win Bullock emerged as the sort of extension of, in a sense, Stieglitz, Minor White, who in that time, by that time, had moved to Rochester, New York, and became curator part-time and also teacher at RIT. That by that time, Win Bullock had sort of like begun to emerge with his pictures like Navigation Without Numbers on the left, done in the mid-50s, as a photographer, in a sense, to be reckoned with from an intellectual standpoint and a conceptual standpoint for young photographers, because he broke away, in effect, from the pre-visualization and the sort of, although he did continue 8x10 contact printing for many years throughout most of his career, as a matter of fact. He did have a tendency to be more adventuresome and break away from some of the well-held conventions of that was associated with the West Coast School of Photography. Another artist, certainly, that came to the Bay Area in the early 40s, actually the mid-40s, was Ruth Bernhardt. And she had met Weston back in the mid-30s, but by the time she had gotten around to coming west from New York, he had gone to Carmel. So she ended up coming to first Hollywood, believe it or not, working as a commercial photographer for a number of years, I believe in the late 30s, early 40s, and then went to San Francisco, where she, of course, resides today. And she, of course, is well known for her very classical nude studies, like evidenced on the left. But prior to that, she did some rather beautifully remarkable still life studies of, for instance, seashells. Which actually she did first in Florida, as opposed to California, before she came out west. But she continued to do still lifes of objects like seashells, and made quite an important series of photographs, and became a very important teacher in the San Francisco Bay Area, and gave many workshops and had monthly critiques that one could pay. In those days, in the 60s, I remember it was $2 or $3, and you could take your portfolio of new work to her for an evening session that would sometime last past the midnight hour. And you got quite an enthusiastic response. And Bernhardt had an ability as a teacher to find something always positive in somebody, everybody's work, irregardless of how well-crafted or well-thought-out it was. Photographer in Los Angeles, who has now become more well-known nationally, is Max Yavno. And Max migrated west. Had been a member at one time, president of the Photo League group in New York in the late 30s, early 40s, which was a group of photographers and still photographers and motion picture photographers that included at times the likes of Paul Strand and Aaron Siskin and W. Jean Smith, for instance, and came west and began to photograph Los Angeles. And Max has these wonderful images, of which these two are kind of classics at this point, of Los Angeles and also San Francisco in the 40s and 50s. And although I'm not showing slides of John Gutman tonight, for instance, from San Francisco, he's another example of a photographer who did a specific work in a particular period of time in the 30s and 40s in the case of Gutman in San Francisco, and has only now been sort of resurfaced with exhibitions of that work. Max was a commercial photographer successfully for many, many years and returned back to fine arts photography in the mid-70s, which he still practices today. Okay, we're into the 50s. We're in a very kind of, we're on a collision path right to the 60s, and I don't think I probably have to tell you about what happened in the 60s in terms of civil rights, political upheaval, and other fascinating, or maybe not so fascinating, occurrences. But in the 50s, we had, as you can see by these slides, the emergence of the beatniks. And there's a group of photographs that, in a documentary sense, do capture and suggest the kind of aggressive creativeness that was going on in those periods. But very little, again, has been done with this work collectively. Granted, some of the work may not be up to the standards that we would like to uphold in terms of fine arts photography, but I do know that there is some really fine work. The work on the right are more like documents of Allen Ginsberg in 1957, picture in the upper left, and the quite regular poetry readings and jazz combinations in the 50s. But this was a period of time in the 50s, particularly in California and particularly in San Francisco, although it did somewhat trail down to L.A. in the terms of Edmund Teske and Eric Nord and a few people like that. A great deal of intermixture, a great deal of cross-pollinization, if you will, of attitudes towards art in general and towards the infusion of photography beyond straight photography as we know it. On the left, you see a photograph of George Herms, and on the right, you see one of his most fascinating assemblages called The Library, which includes a lot of original photographs and collaged and recycled photographs in it. As an example, I show you that. It's part of the well-known assemblage school of art or attitude towards art, which is maybe most epitomized these days by your neighbor next, I guess he's over, who's he, Idaho or Montana, Ed Keenholz, who is probably the king of the assemblage artists. But a little-known artist that came out of that period was Wallace Berman. On the left is a series of his published poems and photographs and drawings. And even though I don't have a slide to show you, he did a very important series based on Jewish icons and relationships to contemporary iconography, in that he took a transistorized portable radio that you could carry in your hand in the 50s, and he put all kinds of like pop-related imagery photographically into these through the Verifax method, and he was one of the first artists to use a mechanical offset type of a machine, a Verifax printer, to incorporate relevant imagery of a sort of social commentary nature into his work. On the right, you have Edmund Teske's photograph of a recycled image that he got in the 1950s from a pile of still lifes from Hollywood films, which Edmund then would re-photograph, and then in printing them, he would apply a duotone solarization technique to it to get this sort of painted, sort of fiery effect of it. Teske came to Los Angeles from Chicago in the early 40s, where he still resides today in Los Angeles in Hollywood. And I think it's through Teske's work that we see the kind of continuation and the adventure of the Bauhaus, the attitude of experimentation, and what in some quarters, I'm sure, in terms of Adams particularly, and maybe Weston as well, I'm not sure, would be considered and even stated in one lecture that Edmund remembers going to, that it was a bastardization of the medium to mess with it, if you will, and to create solarizations and other kinds of affirmations of the medium. But I think when it comes to this kind of photography in the hands of the likes of an Edmund Teske, and the kind of beautiful romantic image, as I would propose, is the picture on the right suggests, of which he has dealt with the male subject as a nude probably more directly and more beautifully than any photographer I'm particularly familiar with. That beginning back in the 40s and into the 50s and 60s till today, Teske still continues to do this kind of work. I feel that he's maybe one of the unsung heroes of multiple imagery today that kind of goes unaccounted for. In 1961-62, Ed Ruscha migrated to Los Angeles from Oklahoma with a bunch of friends, artists out of high school. And of course, that was the emergence of the car culture. And coming to California, everybody had their hot rods of one kind or another. And Ruscha began as an art student in Chouinard School of Art. And upon frequent return trips to Oklahoma, he decided to do a series of gas stations and came out in 1962 with his first book called 26 Gasoline Stations. Well, needless to say, he's gone on to do numerous other photographic-related books since then, and of course is a major painter of the kind of pop icon and word concept style today. But it is this kind of adventuresome spirit, again, that an Ed Ruscha, for instance, from Oklahoma, brought to being in L.A. and to photographing L.A. and to the accumulation of this work into, in this case, a popular, printed, inexpensive publication that began to tremendously influence the potential of the uses of photography in California. In the mid-1960s, there was a major exhibition, as you can see, called Photography in the 20th Century. And the back of the dust jacket, I have put red dots next to the photographers residing or living in California at the time that this exhibition was done. It was done by Nathan Lyons through George Eastman House in Rochester. And I think it's a good indication of the kind of respect that was focused on photography from the West, but primarily, as you can see by reading the names, it dealt with almost exclusively, except for maybe Robert Heineken, who sticks out in the second row there, almost exclusively to straight camera-derived photography. Granted, the publication focuses on that. But at this time, it's a minor triumph, I think, in terms of California and people paying attention to it. 2 years later, in 1967 rather, Nathan Lyons did a very progressive exhibition. The year before this, in 1966, he did an exhibition called Contemporary Photography in the Social Landscape, and that was the first time that the term social landscape had ever been applied towards photography, not of, as we know it, the natural landscape, but of the urban scene, if you will, of the city and so forth, and he referred to it as a social landscape. I think I can unequivocally say that Nathan Lyons, while at George Eastman House as curator of exhibitions, under the tenureship of Beaumont Newhall, who was director at the time, that he did the most significant adventuresome contemporary shows that occurred throughout the whole 60s. One must note that in terms of this kind of tracing of the history and all, and I don't mean to stand up here for hours doing it, but I think we've got to start putting together some perspective and background into the, if you will, figureheads. Edward Steichen succeeded Beaumont Newhall in 1946, the Museum of Modern Art. He did the Family Man exhibition in 1955, the same year that Robert Frank set out on the Guggenheim to photograph America through the eyes of a foreigner. I believe Frank was Swiss, as I recall. The Family of Man, of course, traveled around the world. I think it was duplicated or triplicated and went all over the world and played, if you will, to the largest audiences, maybe to this day, that have ever viewed a single photographic exhibition. Many photographers feel, many on the West Coast for that matter, including Wynn Bullock, feels that that exhibition set fine arts photography back 20 years. The reason being, partly, is that it was a celebration of human mankind, which is fine, but that it took, like Wynn Bullock's photograph of the child in the forest, and he blew it up to large dimensions, whereas, of course, Bullock would have provided an 8x10 contact print as a fine art crafted image, blew it up to large proportions for the express purpose of the design of the exhibition and the impact that Steichen wanted to make upon the way the exhibition was viewed and the way the audience would therefore relate to it. So at the expense of the fine-crafted photograph as a fine art medium, Steichen rather took a kind of a Barnum and Bailey, if you will, attitude to the use of these photographs. So with Frank setting out to do his Americans series, with the likes of that, it took Nathan Lyons, I feel, in the 60s, and one should also mention that John Surkowski succeeded Edward Steichen in 1963 at the Museum of Modern Art and began, of course, his own remarkable series of exhibitions. But at that time, Lyons, in the 60s, had a headwind going, beginning with the Photography of the 20th Century exhibit, going on through the Persistence of Vision here. And in Persistence of Vision, he explored the extended use of photography. And if you can read that, the photographers in that exhibition were Jerry Ulsman, Robert Heineken, Ray Metzger, Jonathan Woods, who probably is a name that you would not recognize, but is a printmaker. Donald Blumberg and Charles Gill, who collaborated on the paintings and photographs. And what I want to do, of course, is focus on Heineken, because this was basically his kind of coming out as a major photographer in relation to this exhibit. Heineken began as a printmaker in the early 60s at UCLA and immigrated to teaching there. And did these sort of nude puzzles. And the idea is that you're looking at triangular-shaped images that are mounted on a piece of wood that's about an inch thick, set in a circular pizza-like tray. And the point is that no more than two or three ever looked hooked up together in any kind of continuation basis. And purposely so. Heineken was constantly involved in sort of throwing us, if you will, curves in terms of what our expectations was of photography and what he wanted to deal with it. On the left, you see a movable block stack of images where he took nude forms and natural forms like trees and all and printed them in different degrees of high contrast, solarization, negative imagery, positive imagery, and combinations of such. And you could actually participate in moving these blocks around. You could move one block or all of them, or whatever you want to do, to participate and explore the image. This piece was about 9 inches high, and the blocks were about 4 to 5 inches square. On the right, you see a series of high contrast figurative pictures of women, which Heineken has collaged behind it, a series based on, this is called Feminist Costumes, February 1968, and of course some of it has to do with commentary on the Vietnamese war, like the right-hand image, sort of a slaughter taking place, the automobile culture, the second from the right, displaced children and what have you. In the case of Heineken, he was not interested in practicing photography as we know it. He is basically, I think, safely to say, a kind of photographic guerrilla. He goes after and recycles imagery. He goes to magazines. He will send away for exposed but undeveloped film, which is sent to him through the mail, which he then develops and uses. He did a series of TV trays on the left, for instance, using photosensitized linen canvas, stretching them over a tray, and then hardening up with a starch so that it would maintain a certain shape. Commentary, popish commentary on TV dinners. On the right is his probably most ambitious large series called the Cliché Verri, which is a takeoff on the French term of that Cliché Verri. And he uses them as erotic statements. This one's titled The Lesbian Vary, and what it is a modular series of photosensitized linen canvases with a repetition of a rather erotic suggestive image of a woman and a dog, and the different portions, as you can see, are juxtaposed on different portions of the panel, and these panels are actually intended to be interchangeable, although he tends to have them fixed in one position. And that piece on the right measures about 5.5 feet square in terms of actual scale. So he's really been aggressively addressing our attitudes about the way that we look at imagery. His work is rather controversial, maybe not so much today as it was 5 or 10 years ago, but he's been working this way since 1967 on the persistence of vision. Oh yes, here's a more recent Heineken piece that is indicative of his, what he calls his he-she series, which is done with SX70 Polaroids. But he's always been one to push the boundaries of language and photography, for instance, sometimes cryptically, sometimes totally sarcastically and humorously, and other times very confrontationally as well. In San Francisco, of course, Jack Wilpott came out in 1961 to begin teaching at the California State College at San Francisco, now San Francisco State University, where, of course, Don Wirth resides and teaches. And in the mid-70s, there was an exhibition done about Jack's work, and you can see it was titled Teacher as Photographer, the Teacher as Artist. I can't quite read that, and the Artist as Teacher. And traced Jack's evolution as an image maker and as a teacher. And I think in terms of Jack's having, he was my mentor, I find it difficult to separate his image ideas and concerns from his teaching ideas and concerns. They are beautifully homogenized together. The picture on the right is titled rather wonderfully, Horse Frees Couple from Plow. And when I saw this picture, and I had no idea where he was picking up the reference for that title, except I thought, well, maybe he just, you know, simply invented this. And I thought, well, it's a, you know, multiracial photograph, which is, you know, slightly controversial. But, well, then they're nude. Well, that's a little more controversial. And then there was this picture of this woman, kind of Victorian era, in the foreground. And then I looked closely at the top of the table, and where some paper had stuck to the table was this quote, the horse frees couple from the plow. And somehow this picture epitomizes for me the psychological penetration and also the kind of intrigue that Jack brings to his, to all of his photography. On the left is a photograph by Jack where he paired two images together. And on the right, I thought I'd show you that in 1960, Imogen Cunningham is still working. She's in her 80s at that point. And here's an unusual variation on the poet's alter ego, a photograph of James Broughton, the San Francisco poet and filmmaker. And Cunningham, of course, was at this time, interestingly to note, Weston, of course, passed away in 1958. Ansel had made his mark in landscape photography and had been quite successful commercially. But Imogen was plugging away, making very straight portraits. She always called herself a hack portrait photographer, day in and day out, to make make ends meet. But she was still exploring the medium, and she started a series of multiple images in the 1960s of this sort on the right. And to her credit, she worked right up until her death in 1976 at the age of 93, well past anybody's expectations and certainly far exceeding what we know of her work back in the 20s and 30s in relation to the F64 group. And finally, it was in 1969-70, and I'm going to end here tonight. Hopefully I'm not disappointing too many of you, because basically it's impossible to deal with the 60s and the 70s reasonably without spending at least 3 or 4 days. there was an exhibition again. It was unfortunately Nathan Lyon's swan song at George Eastman House. He was fired shortly thereafter. Had nothing to do with the exhibition. In 1963, Lyons initiated an exhibition to discover young photographers in the world. He decided, why just keep it in America? It was an international competition based upon recommendations from a large panel of experts throughout the world. And 63 had the first one called Photographics 1963, and in that exhibition at that time surfaced the photographers Paul Caponegro, Lee Freelander, numerous photographers, Marie Cassindis, people that we know very well today. Well, in 1968, he decided 5 years later it was time to do it again. And with a large crew of people to help him, he again sent out the call, and they received so much work that it took him an extra year to put it together. And by that time, he decided to call it Vision and Expression. And in that exhibition, it was remarkable. I forget what the number is. I think out of 140 photographers, as I recall, in that exhibition, I believe 22 or 23 were from California. And it was my sort of calling card, you might say, my first major international exhibition and opportunity to be shown amongst my peers 1 year out of graduate school, as I was. Judy Dater was in it. Numerous people. And what you see here on the right, of course, is a picture titled Cher, 1975, I believe, by Judy Dater. And it's very typical of Judy's kind of psychologically penetrating imagery. And she, of course, had studied with Jack Wellpott, and you might know her in combination with Jack in a book they did called Women and Other Visions, which I think epitomizes not only their attitudes and approaches to photography of women at the time, but begins to reveal the kind of the modernist attitude of how to deal with psychologically revealing significant imagery, as Heineken, as I displayed hopefully in the slides, was beginning to approach and adventuresomely pursuing other kinds of combinations, breaking down the categories, the interdisciplinary categories of printmaking, photography, painting, collage, and the likes. So I suppose one could say, even though it's maybe unfair to, and certainly one cannot say it today, but maybe by 1970, one could say that Southern California, with its kind of aeronautics industry, with its car cultural background, and with its mobility and adventuresome spirit, was probably more into breaking down the traditional barriers of photography and integrating the fine arts of photography in with, the fine arts in general in with photography. And in the Bay Area of San Francisco, that being the other focal point, that there was still sort of one grasp on the traditions of photography, large camera format, in the case of Jack Wellpott, Judy Dater, and others, and the fine crafted print. But I think that the main ingredient of change here is the subject matter and attitude towards subject matter in both Southern California and Northern California that established the concreteness of this idea of contemporary modernism photography. So with a lot of that, which is attempted to be a generally overview, sketchy as it is, I would entertain discussions either here or outside. And thank you very much. Any questions? Or somebody must be sitting out there saying, well, I don't know about what you said about this or that or whatever. I could probably say that if I showed one or two photographers that studied with Heineken, I would probably, and the same with Jack Wellpott, I'd probably be leaving out another two dozen that should probably correctly be mentioned and shown. And maybe that's another lecture. In fact, I once thought that a great exhibition might be to chronicle the impact of teachers like Minor White, let's say, in terms of San Francisco, let's say Henry Holmes Smith in terms of Indiana, and let's say Callahan or Siskin in terms of Chicago, those being areas where education of photography has been going on since the 40s at least, which is unusual given that most education of photography entered into major universities as we know it probably beginning in the early 60s, and by 1970, we really began to occur in many programs. And an interesting exhibition might be to show Minor White, and then the next lineage, which might be Paul Caponegro or Carl Carenza, and then the next lineage after that, which might be whatever. In other words, have two or three or four generations of students that have studied with a certain mentor 20, 25, 30 years ago, and then have the next kind of wave a generation later, and the next wave a generation later. I think maybe a series, granted it's a very ambitious project, anybody want to take it on, I think a series of exhibitions like that would be extremely useful, because there isn't the kind of collective spirit and the comradeship, as I see it, in the schools that I have been associated with or that I sometimes teach workshops at, that I remember, well, 1968, 69, when I was in graduate school. And things have changed a lot. Anyway, that's just kind of another aside comment.
Is there anything you can say about what's going on today, the last 5 years, themes, directions?
Pluralistic, totally pluralistic. Themes. Well, since the 60s, of course, a lot of artists slash photographers have gotten involved in the medium of photography, meaning Lucas Samaras, for instance. Ed Ruscha, I showed you briefly. He's certainly not continuing as a predominant photographer as Samaras is. John Baldessari certainly has been a major influence from a conceptual standpoint in California in terms of his use of photography. So you have, I would say, artists that are they're very interested in conceptualizing ideas and presenting ideas through the expediency of the medium of photography working. You have people that are interested in this idea of fabricated to be photographed, people that might come out of backgrounds of being sculptors or performance artists or relationships of that build sets or create sort of tableaus or situations which they then use a still camera to record or to document, whatever you want to call it. And then they present that in some fashion. You have people interested in what I call sort of like extended soap operas, docudrama approaches to photography. Eileen Cowan comes to mind in terms of California. The best known nationally would be Cindy Sherman as an example. You have, I think, also, and I'd say again, this gets into another series of issues, but I would not hesitate to say it, that you have a lot of self-portraiture going on, but primarily in the area of women photographing themselves, women photographing other women, women photographing situations that are socially, emotionally, psychologically significant to themselves. I still don't see much of that happening in terms of what I know of male photographers. Then you have another thing going on, which is probably an aftermath of the idea of topographics, Louis Baltz being the greatest example of that, where people are interested in photographing topologies, you know, what's going on with urban, suburbia, or site-related, you know, lifestyles. Interesting to note, I was going to show Bill Owens, and of course the impact of his Suburbia publication, which came out about 1970-71, which is a really major publication and attitude. He was working for the Livermore newspaper at the time out near Walnut Creek, San Francisco area, and photographed suburbia. He's now recently opened up a pub where he's making his own beer. He's one of four or five pub owners in Hayward, California. That's no you know, slap at Bill Owens, but it's indicative of how photographers, say in their 40s or thereabouts, are changing careers out of photography into something else. He's maybe a exception, but that's nevertheless an example. Finally, I think we're going to see more work in terms of painting large-scale concerns and tableau relationships to photography, where photography and like Sandy Skoglund's work, even though you haven't heard much from her, she's gone back to sculpture mostly because it's easier and she can get more money for it than spending a year building a very elaborate tableau and then making one photograph of it, even though she can command a good price tag for it, it doesn't pay off over the long run. The marketplace, therefore, has had a major effect, I mean really a major effect, upon some of the more adventuresome and therefore expensive approaches to photography, like large-scale color work and large-scale combinations of mediums. Chris Enos has access, for instance, in Boston to the 8-foot or whatever it is by 4-foot Polaroid camera that's bolted down to the museum floor of the Boston Museum of Fine Arts. But you know, she can't get into it that much, and it's too expensive to use, and so she's made an interesting series, I think, of pictures, but we probably won't really see them. So there is some exploration, like Chris Enos's example, going on, but I think it's going through a period of really sorting out, and the infiltration of art in general is becoming more and more prevalent in photography. And I frankly think two things: that you can't just have a photography education these days. You've got to have a general art education. And secondly, you've got to be able to at least be somewhat articulate and probably be able to write about your positions, about your attitudes, about the medium. I don't think you can just strictly be a visual artist anymore within and want and be able to plug in to the outlets of academia, of galleries, publications, and things without having some ability to write and or articulate your positions. I mean, there are photographers that survived very nicely in the 40s and 50s or before that I probably talked about today that would have a heck of a time surviving under the attitudes and some of the pressures of today's world. Yes?
I enjoyed the talk very much, and I wonder if you would comment. I happen to really enjoy, for a number of reasons, photographs as they come in the newspaper.
Yes, I hear you.
I wonder, how do you fit those photographs?
One of the local newspapers to do a series of photographs that will appear in a social political context of his authorship in the newspaper as actually subscribed artwork that the newspaper is providing space for. Now that's one thing that's just beginning to happen in this country. It's happened in other countries, in Europe particularly, a little more often. Of course, you have your independently printed newspapers and the likes, but I'm talking about major newspapers. that have, large circulations. But in terms of your question, as I think I understand it, the photographs, yes, are the how would I say this? The impact of those photographs, I think, and the success of them as pictures is getting much better. I think you just simply have smarter, more intelligent, quicker, more capable photographers working for newspapers these days. Like I mentioned, Bell Owens worked for the Livermore newspaper in the 60s when he was doing Suburbia. My God. if they knew what he was doing, he probably would have been, maybe they did know what he's doing. But anyway, nevertheless, he was quite an exceptional photographer. I think you have four or five or six good photographers working for like the LA Times or the Herald Examiner that I'm familiar with in LA. As far as their work being elevated to, this fine arts context or being seen upstairs in a museum context, I don't know. I think it's much too soon to conjecture on that. But certainly I don't think we can dismiss, some of the photography that we now see. But of course, then you have to consider the initial intention and premise for those kinds of pictures. And they are being made for quick newspaper consumption. And I think that the museums have to leave their doors open and their attitudes very broad to embrace good work. But I think it's going to be a while before the kind of photography you may be referring to will occur in what I would call a kind of fine arts context museum, verification. We're getting into a very interesting period of time. It's been approximately 15 years since 1969 and the emergence of the marketability of fine arts photography, a la Lee Witkin's gallery opening in March of 1969 in New York, and the beginning of very successful auctions and all. And if you haven't heard about it, I might make the announcement. I'm sure some of you have. We now have, in an instantaneous large, I call, buyout, of about 10 major collections throughout the world, one of the world-class archives of original photographs now ensconced in Malibu, yes, Malibu, at the J. Paul Getty Museum. They just bought 18,000 plus photographs from 10 of the most important collectors, Sam Wagstaff, for instance, Arnold Crane from Chicago, Wilde from Cologne, Germany, Bockelberg from Hamburg, Germany, couple collections out of England, and I don't recall some of the other ones by name. And they're negotiating with André Jam, who has the most important collection of French early works on paper in the world, to buy a selection of that material, because the French are real stingy about what they want to let out of the country historically. But nevertheless, which they should be, nevertheless, it's a major coup, an absolute major coup. And it's going to change, I think, not only people's traveling itineraries, number one, but it's going to bring, therefore, major researchers and major historical events to not only the West Coast and California, but certainly, you know, you're just an hour and a half away or 2 hours away here. And certainly, you know, serious people are going to have to go to the Getty to see, between them and the Huntington Library and what you have here in Portland, the major collection of Carlton Watkins photographs.